This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on September 12, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, September 12, 2013 will now come to order. We have four commissioners at the table, and Commissioner Walther is joining us by phone. I apologize for the delay for those who came to watch the proceedings and anybody who happens to be listening online. We had some late submitted documents, and of course we wanted to wait until we could establish contact with Commissioner Walther. So we will begin with the first item of the agenda, which is correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I make the motion, I have a parliamentary inquiry, if I could. I see item 5, enforcement manual, says to be held over to a future meeting. Could I ask about that? Who's holding?
I suppose you are asking about that. I am holding with the support of Commissioner Walther,
okay.
As you know, because he sent around an email.
Well, his email didn't say who was holding. Correct?
Said he was supporting the hold.
Right. But the hold was in the passive voice. The email did not say who was holding, correct?
Right. The email said that he was supporting the hold, yes, and I am holding as well, yes.
Okay. If I could take a point of personal privilege on that. Thank you.
Feel free.
The enforcement manual has taken on this issue has taken on a life of its own. And I think in many ways that's a good thing, because it represents and symbolizes two entirely different worldviews on how the FEC ought to function. But what is clear to me is that this is not going to be considered while I'm still a commissioner. It's clear that there's this. I've heard, well, we need six commissioners. We've heard that there's going to be a Republican power grab with a 3-2 vote. We've heard a lot of excuses, all of which really have been debunked. We all know we don't need six commissioners to conduct business. We also know that we're not going to do some 3-2 vote to jam a manual down people's throats. In fact, I've written two letters to editors of two different newspapers that had blatantly false editorials on the point, where, because in my view, the manual goes to what the statute means. It takes four votes to adopt, and that could not be clearer under the Act, that the Commission construes the Act, and when it construes the Act, it takes four votes. It's unfortunate that it's turned into this, and I guess I take it as a weird backhanded compliment that I don't get to be involved, and somehow having me involved is that threatening. What's frustrating, though, is that the longer this goes, the more questions get raised, and the worse it looks. And for anyone to say with a straight face that we have a functioning process now is absurd. The fact is, we don't. Just this week, we had a case. We've closed it out, but it's not public yet, so I'm not going to identify the respondent. But we had a case where. And when the public sees it, you'll be able to, well, maybe not be able to see it, because some of this doesn't, for whatever reason, go public. But a case where a complaint came in and OGC sent a letter to the respondent asking for factual information. We're not talking about reading a newspaper and sending a newspaper for comment. We are, in my view, propounding discovery. We're talking about propounding discovery before a reason to believe vote, which, under the Act, is not permitted, and then the case even gets more bizarre, where once the factual information came in, the vendor that was identified as having conducted a service for the person who was actually named in the complaint was sent a letter saying that a complaint had been filed against them, indicating that they had violated federal law. Well, that no complaint had been filed against this against this third-party vendor. They were merely a vendor for a campaign. It is not a good feeling to receive a letter from the federal government saying you violated federal law and there's a complaint, it may have violated federal law due to a complaint when there is no complaint against you. The problem with all this is that there is no process that I know of that gets to the heart of this. And what I've been trying to do since I've been here is open this up and get processes in place. And what goes on pre-RTB is one of the areas that, well, there have been quite a lot of, there's been quite a bit of discussion in various MERS, and I've tried to have this discussion so the public can be a part of it. And unfortunately, that's not going to happen. There's not much I can do about it. It's the way it is, I suppose. But the more the truth comes out on what's been happening, the worse it's going to look. And then there's the other issue with reaching out before reason to believe with the Internal Revenue Service. Still don't have good answers on that one. Questions continue to mount. Just today, there's another news clip that talks about emails from the Hill, I guess, is released from the IRS. And again, it's tough to piece this together because, you know, MERS are confidential, and until they go public, you don't really get to see the timing of how things are moving and whether they're moving quickly and slowly and how this stuff impacts current MERS. And I really can't get into current MERS, but eventually this is going to, what I've been saying is going to come out. It's going to come out piecemeal, and it's not going to look good. And this news clip that I'm talking about says, and I'm going to read it, the emails also put the targeting in the context of the media and congressional drumbeat over the impact of conservative campaign spending on the 2012 elections. On July 12, 2012, then Lerner advisor, that's referenced to Lois Lerner, advisor Sharon Light emailed Ms. Lerner a national public radio story on how outside money was making it hard for Democrats to hold their Senate majority. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee had complained to the Federal Election Commission that conservative groups like Crossroads GPS and Americans for Prosperity should be treated as political committees rather than 501c4s, which are tax-exempt social welfare groups that do not have to disclose their donors. Quote, perhaps the FEC will save the day, unquote, Ms. Lerner wrote back later that morning. That response suggests Ms. Lerner's political leanings, and it also raises questions about Ms. Lerner's intentions in a separate email exchange she had when an FEC investigator inquired about the status of the conservative group, the American Future Fund. The FEC and the IRS don't have the authority to share that information under Section 6 of 6103 of the Internal Revenue Code, but the bigger question is why did they want to? After the FEC inquiry, the American Future Fund also got a questionnaire from the IRS. These are the kind of questions that if we had a written procedure in place, we wouldn't even really have to ask because this sort of thing wouldn't have happened. But now that these things are happening and it's in the public, it really is incumbent upon the commission to act sooner rather than later, get to the bottom of this. And really, the enforcement manual is the perfect vehicle to discuss this. Not to discuss it and cast aspersions, but to figure out what happened and see what sort of process we need in place so that this sort of thing can't be questioned. If there's a proper way to do things pre-RTB, I think me and my colleagues are all ears. That's just not the way we read the statute. But regardless, there's just no procedure. Finally, the timing of many of these cases is very troubling to me. We have cases that have been sitting, waiting for OGC reports for up to 2 years. Why? Well, in some of these cases, my guess is they're probably conducting pre-RTB discovery. So this is something that also bogs down the process and slows down MERS. Some of these MERS, this is the second, we're waiting for second reports, meaning the first report was withdrawn because, well, it wasn't that good or there were issues. And I don't want to get into specifics on what responded and what case, but I can talk about these sort of things generally. And the timing of this stuff becomes very troubling. And when you put it all together, it's a very, very bad picture. Eventually, this will all come out. And when it comes out, it's not going to look good. And I want to be on record as saying I am doing everything I can to prevent it, and I am pushing to have this sort of discussion in a public meeting about what the procedures ought to be going forward, because the commission is in sore need of dealing with these sorts of issues. And the public needs to be a part of this. So I've explained to a couple different folks in the media who like to write things about all the evil the Republicans are doing here and how we're stopping the staff from doing things and whatnot. just keep in mind, you wouldn't know any of this but for the fact that we insisted on this being in a public meeting, and we have made documents public and asked to have documents public and put out memos and whatnot discussing all this. It was with the support of the commission that this was put into the public. Years past, the commission would have these discussions behind closed doors. This is a discussion that can't be behind closed doors. I'm ready to have the discussion, but the precedent now is that a commissioner can hold something in perpetuity. That's how it is. And ordinarily, I do not talk when someone gives a hold, but there's also a precedent because we had a hold on this very same issue, in July, and the chair nonetheless made a statement regarding the substance. So I am not breaking new ground here by commenting on something that's being held, but I want to state this for the record, because the longer this goes on, the more the questions mount, the more difficult it gets to explain, and the more I see, the more I don't like it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. As you note, normally when we hold things over, we don't discuss them. You've raised a lot of issues that go to the substance of the matters that we're not discussing, as well as some enforcement matters that haven't been made public yet, so I'm not going to address those. But really, I know that you're taking this very personally, but it's actually not about you. It's about, well, right now it looks like there are two empty seats over here, but we've got somebody on the phone, but it's about that empty chair over there. Could I finish, please, Commissioner Hunter?
Yes. I didn't say a word. I just raised my hand.
Okay. We have, at the moment, three Republicans, one Democrat, one independent, no general counsel. I understand you think that's a great time to be proceeding on considering changes to the operating procedures of the agency. It doesn't seem that way to me. And it's not just me. We've received a lot of comments from public interest groups, from members of the Senate. You may disagree with the editorials, but there have been a number of editorials that have also said we should wait for the pending nominees to get here, in part because they're the ones who are going to have to live under any new procedures that the commission may or may not choose to adopt. And they deserve a say in that. And they deserve a say in how the agency is going to operate going forward. And I'm happy to hear that you believe the enforcement manual would require four votes, but you have also shown a willingness to use the fact that there are three of you on that side of the table and fewer on our side of the table to raise procedural motions and to at least threaten to try and control the terms of the debate on a three-vote majority. And I will say to you that I have been at the commission when there have been five commissioners in the past, and there were three on my side of the table and two on the other side of the table. And never once in those times, never once, not in private, not in public, not even when the three of us were just sitting around the room by ourselves, never once did any of the people on my side of the table suggest that on a procedural matter, on a substantive matter, on any matter at all that came before this commission, that anything should pass on a so-called three-vote majority. We did not treat our colleagues that way. It raises a big issue for me, so that I need to make sure that as we are discussing major changes to the way the commission has been operating for years, for decades, the commission staff have included publicly available information in their recommendations. There's nothing new or secret about that. And if we're going to consider changes to basic operating procedures of the Office of General Counsel, yes, I think it would be better if we actually had a general counsel. And I regret that we were not able to start this discussion when we still did have a general counsel. But since then, things have changed, and we have nominees pending, and it looks like they're moving relatively rapidly. I believe that this debate is important, and I just want to make sure that when it takes place on a level playing field. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Another point of personal privilege to respond to some of that. It's not that I'm taking it personally. And it's interesting that you characterize it as taking it personally. But what is true is that by insisting on filling the empty chair, it's rather algebraic that that means I'm not involved. So it's hard not to see that it has something to do with that. The notion that new commissioners who are not here should have a say in a manual that has been in a draft form for close to a year strains credulity. Moreover, it's not that they have to live under the manual. It's the people out there, and I point to the audience, who have to live under the manual. The manual is designed to assure objective public processes to protect those who are accused of wrongdoing, to ensure that there's integrity in the process so the public has confidence in what the commission does, to ensure that there's not ad hoc processes that expose the commission to potential accusations of targeting or partisanship. It's not that the new folks have to live under the manual. Quite to the contrary, they have to abide by the manual. It's not for the benefit of the commissioners. It doesn't make the commissioners feel good. It makes the public feel good. So let's get straight on who's the dog and who's the tail in this equation. We work for the people. They don't work for us. And I'm here as a public servant. I'm not elected. I'm appointed by the president. I'm confirmed by the Senate. I have an honorable in front of my title. But that's nothing compared to the people. I work for them. So it's not about me. It's about doing the right thing. And my point is the people are not being served well today, and they have not been served well for quite some time because this discussion has not been had. And we can't even begin the discussion. Maybe it gets picked up down the road. But look, when you take one of these jobs in Washington, D.C., your mail is labeled occupant. It's not really your name on the letterhead. This chair is not my chair. This chair was the same chair that Dave Mason sat in. It was the same chair that Tom Josefiak sat in. It was the same chair that Trevor Potter sat in. It's none of our chairs. It's just one seat on the Federal Election Commission. And it doesn't really matter who sits here, because there should be a larger goal of ensuring that the public has confidence in the processes and that there's some objectivity on what goes on here. Now, what are those processes? You've referenced changing the process, major changes to the process. The fact is there is no process. To claim that there is some sort of process, and it's a longstanding process that's been in place for years, is provably false. That is not the case. There are just too many examples that show that to be the case. And in fact, this has been a recent surge in some of the things that OGC has been doing. This is not old stuff. Talking directly about use of newspaper articles. They were never used for their truth if they were not included in the complaint. They were used for background information. The old 1997 version of the OGC manual talks about using such public information for background material, not for its truth. It's hearsay. But yet now it gets included in OGC reports and larded into the complaint. And if it's part of the complaint, it's not part of the complaint. That's new. And I've been doing this much too long to know what's new and what's not new. And it's simply just not true to say that somehow what the commission's been doing for years has been uninterrupted for years. It's not. You yourself told the chairman of the House Administration Committee that the old manual was never really a manual. It was a collection of stuff put together. Not even all commissioners didn't even have full copies, apparently. So you yourself have already said the old manual is no manual at all. But now you sit here and say, oh, there's longstanding procedures. Where are they? Just this week we had a discussion about how we name respondents in cases. Now, there was Ralph Nader went to court against the FEC recently, and we were chastised by the federal court that we didn't properly serve all the respondents, and under the statute they had an opportunity to be heard. And so far the commission has done nothing to address that. Are we doing it correctly? Who knows? And when it comes to the commissioners, I can't recall too many commissioners other than me asking questions about this. Now, apparently there's a procedure that is used to do this and generate, but that's not public. Still, not public. We also learned from the counsel's office that this manual that they've drafted isn't the final word. There may be other policies. They want to reserve judgment on. There may be other policies they haven't found that they may want to use somewhere else. When are we going to learn that's not acceptable? This isn't personally about me, but I take it very personally because it's just wrong to do this. You can't have a federal agency that makes it up as it goes along. You can't have ad hoc procedures because then respondents think it's who the respondent is. Respondents take it personally. I see cases where there's quite a bit of material sent 6 months after the initial response comes in to certain respondents, but not all respondents. How can that be? Sometimes it's newspaper articles. Sometimes it's just the articles that are inculpatory, not the exculpatory articles. How can that be? Sometimes they ask for factual information prior to reason to believe. How can that be? The major change, I suggest, is doing all this pre-reason to believe. And this is a recent phenomenon. The commissioners have had no input in this. At least the Republican commissioners have had no input on this. We're here. We're commissioners. We're not the 13th floor of a hotel. This weird zone where we exist, but we don't. This discussion needs to happen, and it needs to happen sooner rather than later. Now, your reference to using a 3-2, I need to respond to that. It's odd coming from a commissioner who attempted to have meetings when the commission lacked a quorum to say somehow I'm doing something funny and unprecedented. There were two commissioners for 6 months in 2008, you considered advisory opinions and actually wrote opinions. You wrote the speech now opinion. It went 1-1. Commissioner Mason said there would not be contribution limits. You said there would be. D.C. Circuit sided with Commissioner Mason on that. There are other advisory opinions. It was bizarre. And now you're going to sit here and say, gee, everything has to be done regular order. We need six commissioners. And it's never happened before where commissioners have done things in smaller groups. You were part of the smaller group. People were hired when there was no quorum. GS-15s, which under commission directives requires commission approval. How did that happen? It did. So it seems like when the shoe's on one foot, it's okay, but when it's on the other foot, it's not okay. Now, to address directly the 3-2, it is true that I did say majority covers. My view is it does on procedural issues, and it's on my view. Office of General Counsel agreed. The directives say so. And the reason why it probably never came up before is there was never a situation where a chair was attempting to cut off the other side in debate. And that's what happened, and I didn't like it. You tried to cut me off in discussing a MER, in deliberating a MER. And I understand you don't like it. You've grown very weary of me sitting here and talking all the time. Many people have. Not everyone has. But we were left with no choice because when one side tries to cut the other side off on deliberating, the only protection we have is the procedural rules. And remarkably, once I said the procedural rules will be used to avoid one side being silenced, you never did it again, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. I made the point, and things have proceeded much smoother since then. Because each commissioner matters. Look, the FEC is not like other agencies. It's not like the FCC or the SEC with an odd number. There's not a chair especially appointed by the president. Chair doesn't get to pick the council or anything of the sort. We are six, currently five, co-equal knights of the round table. When you have a title, and I've had the title chairman, I'm now titled vice chairman, you have a lot more homework to do. You have to worry about managing the agency and moving things along. But at the end of the day, when it comes to votes, it still requires a vote of the commission, and it still requires that the statute be adhered to. So this idea that somehow there's been some partisan power grab behind the scenes is unprecedented, again, I take issue with and I think is false. I think it was a reaction to overreach on your part. Fortunately, I thought we had put that behind us, and things have moved much better once we had an understanding that we all get to share our views. But I can't let you just throw this out and say, well, you know, somehow we've been concocting something, and somehow nobody's ever thought of this before, and that sort of thing. just looking at the directives, that's obviously not true, because the directives do talk about when you can do majority rule. The statute itself is majority rule, except for certain enumerated things, like voting reason to believe, issuing depositions, subpoenas, finding probable cause, initiating lawsuits, that sort of thing. So even the statute talks about majority rule, but we're not going to do majority rule on the enforcement manual. That was a much, much ballyhooed rumor that seemed to be foisted on us by reform groups and editorial boards. It's not true. I've already written publicly on that. That excuse is now off the table. So it is what it is. I understand it's not going to be considered, that it's going to be held in perpetuity. Until so-called new commissioners show up, because somehow we owe it to them. And maybe there's probably some merit to that. I mean, it would have been nice if when I was appointed and I came in, I had a say in some things that had happened in late 2007. It would have been nice if I had a say in some things that happened in early 2008. It would have been nice if I had a say in maybe some budgetary issues, but I didn't, and because I wasn't a commissioner until I was a commissioner. But I don't sit here and say, gee, you know, I wasn't here, so I should have had input in something that happened before I got here. That's not how you play the game. But maybe it is how we play the game now.
Well, just a moment. I will recognize you in a moment, Commissioner Hunter. I just want to respond to just a couple of the points that my colleague made. We have now spent a very long time talking about something that, according to the agenda, we weren't going to talk about, but that's okay. I understand my colleague has been frustrated and wanted to get a few things out there. There are many, many things that you just said that I disagree with. I'm not going to go through them one by one, but there are two things that I am going to respond to. At the end of 2007, the commission unanimously rewrote the directives to try and figure out exactly what could two commissioners do, as we foresaw that situation coming upon us, in order to keep the lights on and keep the agency operational. And obviously, we could not issue advisory opinions, but we felt that under the statute, the commission is supposed to meet. So the two of us that were here, we met. And neither one of us, neither Commissioner Mason nor I, were under any delusion that we could issue an advisory opinion. However, we thought if people were submitting an advisory opinion, the least we could do was to tell them what our views were. And in no matter whether we agreed or disagreed, we knew that the requesters were still going to get the same answer, and that was going to be, for lack of four votes, you don't get an advisory opinion, because there weren't four votes to be had. And everyone understood that. We just thought, to the extent it's useful to folks, there's, you know, here's two commissioners, this is what we think on these issues. I really somewhat regret having to go through this, because I know this is going to just generate another comment. But I never cut you off. You had held the floor for half an hour, grilling the staff quite intensely, and another commissioner raised his hand during a pause in the questioning after you had received an answer, and I called on him. And you said, I wasn't finished yet. And when I said, well, Commissioner Walther raised his hand, and now it's his turn, you walked out of the room rather than give another commissioner a chance to say anything at all before we would return to you. And that is what happened. And then when we came back after lunch, we had an hour and a half long debate about whether the chair gets to control time at the table, whether once a commissioner is called on, he gets to monopolize discussion all day long. I thought that was rather a waste of time, but you made your point that you were prepared to, you know, take steps that I had never seen taken before. And I have taken that lesson to heart, and I have been guided by the notion that it could happen again at any time. And that is one of the things that I bear in mind. This notion of the three-vote majority and the notion that perhaps an enforcement manual could be adopted on fewer than four votes is not one that was raised on our side of the table. But it did get out into the public arena, and it's been debated, and there are people on listservs and other places that have now said, yeah, we think they could do it with three votes. For all I know, a judge might take that point of view. And I, as I said, need to ensure that when this discussion takes place and if any votes are held, that it's done on a level playing field to make sure that the four-vote rule really does pertain, and any procedures for this agency are only adopted on a bipartisan vote. Commissioner Hunter, you wanted to say something. It appears that she is. I wanted you to know I haven't forgotten that you wish to speak, Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you.
But if you wish to defer to the Vice Chairman, by all means.
I'll leave it that we have a slightly different recollection on what transpired. But it sounds like we agree. I did make a point that had an effect, and it's a shame that it had to get to that to make the point. Just two things. On the lack of quorum, the first part of 2008, the Act says a quorum requires four commissioners. You can rewrite the directives unanimously all you want. Quorum says four, it means four. The fact is, you had meetings, votes were cast. There's certs, vote certs. You voted without a quorum. The NLRB tried the same thing. It went to court. The U.S. Supreme Court said, nice try. You can't operate without a quorum. Statute means what it says. On the 3-2 for an enforcement manual, whether or not a judge would accept it, who knows, but I'm glad that you invoked that, because there is a question of how one gets judicial review of such things, and the fact that you are musing as to whether a judge would accept a 3-2 must mean, therefore, we do have agreement that the commission must at least vote on the manual, and with a vote that would at least give somebody potentially somehow a way to take judicial review of what we're doing in our procedures. I've seen this trick here before where staff sort of has their own procedures, and I've never seen a way to get judicial review of such things. But I'm glad to see that we at least agree that the commission has to vote, because that's the only way the public can really, if they want to, seek the appropriate review in front of an Article III judge.
You may be over interpreting what I said, Commissioner, but Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to associate myself with the comments of the Vice Chair. This has been a long, ongoing discussion on how we're going to consider the enforcement manual. As I mentioned last time, it all started at the House Oversight hearing in November 3rd of 2011. And I believe now, that we should have a public enforcement manual that's voted on by the Commission. That, as the Vice Chair suggested, the idea that we just have a part of the manual public and there's other things that are kept secret within this building is completely unacceptable. I'm not prepared to go back before the House Administration Committee and tell them that, sorry, we couldn't get four votes on it, or we don't think it's the kind of thing that needs the vote of the Commission. It's the Commission's enforcement manual. We've tried to be very respectful of certain things that the Office of General Counsel wants to do within their sort of parameter that they're given under the statute. And we describe it, used a light pen in those areas. But there are numerous issues that we now can't even discuss, which I think is completely unacceptable. We are sitting commissioners right now. We do care about what the new commissioners think when they get here. But they're not here yet, and we should at a minimum be able to discuss these issues. We have said that we're not going to jam this down 3-2 vote on this issue because we think it's important enough that it needs four votes. I agree that we probably could have done that, and a lot of those memos, first of all, relying on the statute, and second of all, relying on some of the very same memos that you cited that were used when there were only two commissioners. The Office of General Counsel said there was a whole bevy of things that we could do with here at this commission with three votes. But we have said we think that this is important enough, and it should be a bipartisan document that we would like to have four votes for it. We have been working with at least one of our colleagues on this. Commissioner Walther at one point was talking with us behind the scenes a little bit, and we appreciate his efforts, you know, back then. He's sort of he's backed off a little bit, and I haven't spoken with the chair on the substance of this issue since it started, which is unfortunate. And again, I think it's outrageous that we haven't discussed this, you know, in a public setting with the sitting commissioners. As I said, there's a number of issues that are going on every day. Respondents have to respond to complaints every day without an enforcement manual. It's completely unacceptable. They don't know what the rules are, and that leads to unfair treatment, in my view. We don't even know what the penalty schedule is. You, Madam Chair, have said since I got here that you thought that the penalty schedule should be public. Well, guess what? We've attached a penalty schedule in our proposal of the enforcement manual. We're willing to vote on that. We're willing to discuss it. We're willing to take any edits you have to it. But we have a clear proposal on what the penalty schedule should be. That's something that we should talk about. The public shouldn't be made to guess any longer on that issue. Another one, in the past couple of weeks, information has come to light about a matter that's now closed, an enforcement case, MER 6234, the CNEC matter. And I've been particularly troubled by some of the information that just came to light that I actually didn't know about, even though I was the chair of this place when these letters were being circulated. The Office of General Counsel sent the file over to the Department of Justice on August 23rd, told them about the case, I should say, on August 23rd, and shortly thereafter sent the entire file over. The case was sent to CRU because they were the complainant in the matter on August 22nd of last year. August 20th of last year, and CRU posted it on their website on August 22nd. So the email went over from the FEC the day after it was posted by CRU on their website, but the Office of General Counsel notifies the Department of Justice that this person, Mr. Cenac, made an unqualified admission of knowing and willful conduct, and this matter has been on his list to direct to your attention since we obtained the deal, which I don't know what date he's talking about, but I have to assume that he means on July 30th, a month before the matter was made public. So it appears as if the intention was to share the matter with the Department of Justice before it was public. The conciliation agreement is publicly available on the FEC website, I believe, but we of course have additional materials we can make available if you're interested in pursuing. So here we have the Office of General Counsel sharing information about a MER without consulting the commission at all, without even telling us that they're planning to do this. And there is no policy governing this conduct. Even in the Office of General Counsel's proposal in the enforcement manual as it stands now, there's nothing that addresses the Office of General Counsel initiating contact with the Department of Justice before a case is made public or after. There is nothing. In the proposal that we have set forward, we have spelled out in great detail, with a lot of careful consideration, a policy that we think adequately addresses the needs of the FEC to enforce the law, which nobody doesn't want to do, but also to protect respondents and to let the public know what the process is. So when they enter into conciliation agreement with the Federal Election Commission, they know what the rules of the road are. That brings up another issue in this case. Recently disclosed letters suggest that in conciliation, we don't have all the information yet, so I can't get into all the details, but suggests that the respondent in this matter was under the impression that the FEC would not share information about this case with the Department of Justice. In a letter written to the FEC on October 9th of 2012, it says, again, as we discussed, Mr. Cenac agreed to resolve this matter through conciliation based in substantial part on the FEC's agreement not to refer this matter to DOJ, USAO for criminal prosecution. Again, I wasn't in the conciliations. I didn't even know about the conciliation agreement and the fact that there was an issue regarding things that were agreed to or maybe not agreed to, but it's something that's very troubling and something that we should talk about in the context of the enforcement manual, and I look forward to doing that soon. We don't know when the new commissioners are going to be coming on board. As you know, Madam Chair, there was another nominee a few years ago that we thought was going to be here, and you even gave your farewell speech, and that person's not even here. So,
but there's no empty seat. There was no empty seat at the time.
But we've told you that we're not going to vote on this in a 3-2 matter. I mean, maybe there's other procedural issues that are
more relevant for a 3-2 majority rule, but we've said this is not one of them. We at least want to have the conversation.
Well, it sounds like we are having the conversation. We're having a remarkable amount of conversation on a topic that it says on the agenda was going to be held over. And I'm very disturbed about we don't even have anybody from enforcement in the room because it was not supposed to be discussed today. And you're bringing up details from past cases, and people are not here to address what happened. I will just say that as you actually conceded, the information that was relayed to the Department of Justice was already public on somebody's website. So I'm going to rein this back in. I thought my colleague just wanted to have a few moments to express himself on the process, and I decided that was, you know, appropriate, but it's really kind of gone a little bit far afield. We have a lot of people here who are waiting for answers to questions, and I would like to return to the actual next item on the agenda, which is Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-4. Yes, Commissioner Walther.
I'm not interested in extending the conversation much longer, but I would like to make a couple of very short points, if I may.
Absolutely.
Let's talk briefly about where we have been coming from in terms of the progress that's been made in this agency. This agency has been in existence for over 35 years. When we started in the last, I'd say, 4 years, and I would say certainly Commissioner McGann was supportive of these, the commission has made unprecedented improvements in the transparency and the ability of the public and the respondents to participate in our deliberative process. And I don't think that has been adequately pointed out. The impression that's been given is somehow there's an effort to quietly keep information from the public. Now I think it's important to point out that any of the complaints about that are ones that probably could have been made quite some time ago, before all this arrived. But I would point out we have eliminated materials for the and for the consideration of the enforcement manual. We've improved procedural rules for audit hearings, procedure for notice of respondents of non-complaint generated matters, for amendments of the agency procedure for probable cause hearings, and the policy regarding placing first order accounts for report in the public record, something new. Guidebook for complaints and response from the FEC enforcement process. That particular document is the first time that we've ever tried to help the public and the respondents to understand what happens when a complaint is filed. A lot of work went into that, and that's been public on the website since 2009. That has been the first time in over 30 years that there's been an actual description of our process, our whole enforcement process for the public. And when I say whole, it went from the very beginning to the very end. Yes, there's more to be added to the extent we want to, but let's just make this clear that this has been an overriding concern of all of us to make this whole process more transparent and more fair. We've had the Directive 68 on the enforcement procedures. We have the Directive 69, which was to legal guidance with the Office of Compliance. We have the FEC Directive in processing audit reports. We've provided hearings available in reference to the Commission for giving opinions midway between the audit process, so we don't have to wait till the very end of the audit process and find out that it's been moving along a legal track that the Commission did not agree with. We've had agency disclosure documents and information on enforcement matters, procedure for doing that. One of the things that I think is very important to point out is that for the first time, we actually adopted a policy to make sure that when we get information provided to us and in the investigative process, it is not at the PRTV stage a prosecutorial issue. It's an investigative fact-finding issue that needs to be objective so that all inculpatory and exculpatory information is made available on a fair and non-advocacy basis for the consideration by the Commission. And I think, despite all that's been said this morning, the people who are involved day in and day out in the enforcement process, and some of the top lawyers in the country are those, will tell you that we've made dramatic improvements over the last 4 or 5 or 6 years in making our process more fair, more deliberative, more objective, and more transparent. So, is there enough to be said? Have we done enough? I would say no. But let me also say that for the last 35 years, what's been called the enforcement manual has been a guidance for internal lawyers in the process. It has to do with a lot of minutia involving how you get things done. I still think that the general counsel should be entitled to have, as a firm or anything else, their own internal guidelines on when you move something from one team to another, or when you begin to bring things out, or how you handle certain matters. And you don't necessarily need to come to the commission for a vote every time an officer general counsel wants to modify his internal procedures on how to make things. At all times, they have to comply with the policies that we have in full force and effect. I would tell you that for the first time since I've been on the commission in the fall, the public has had the opportunity to see what we now would say the enforcement manual that's currently in effect. And Tony Herman immediately passed to our council, made public the fact that this is our operative document. There's no question right now of what it is. The question is, I think, whether we agree, whether some people agree with it. I'm aware of two major areas where we are in disagreement, but the ones that have been extant for a long, long time. One is the pre-reasonable area, and the extent to which the Office of General Counsel can look to facts outside the complaint. That is an issue that's been before us, and there's good arguments on both sides. This has been played to make it sound as if there's an effort to quell any ability of the Office of General Counsel to look at any case or any fact outside the process in the pre-IPD stage, even if it might be completely inculpatory. I don't think that's the right procedure, but I think even our Republican colleagues would agree that's not the right way either. So we have, I think, distilled, I would say probably 90% of what you see is probably ones that all of us would agree are satisfactory procedures. The way in which we communicate interagency-wide is certainly one that's emerged. And I also feel that, I'm even talking with Mr. Commissioner again, we probably can come pretty close to reaching an agreement on finalizing the policy on that. But sometimes there's a slip between the cup and the lip, but I think we really have made some headway in narrowing that process a lot. So I do think we need a methodology. We've done that and recognized that for some time. And having to have a policy that is more internal guidelines in terms of how we communicate not only with the Department of Justice, but how the Office of General Counsel communicates with us as commissioners. I do think we need more reporting and less automatic transmission of documents over there. Let me say one more thing. There has been some public comment about the fact that there would be a real negative impact on our ability to enforce the law. We should limit the way in which we work with the Department of Justice by requiring a subpoena in each instance. To my knowledge, that procedure has been in effect up until a couple of years ago. So it would not be fair to say that just because someone argues that we will not transmit any documents over to the Department of Justice unless there is a procedure, would be trying to impede normal prosecution on either the part of the Department of Justice or us, because that policy has been in effect for a long time. It's been softened, and to the point where I think we need to firm up what those guidelines are going to be going forward. But the own process is one that's been it's been criticized, but we have been in effect for a long time. I recognize them, and I have the same concerns that Mr. Gannon has about trying to change things around here. But I would say, too, that the reason matter that has come before the commission on new facts, right, on new facts in the law, we have still been able to gather the necessary support to get that in place. And that basically is a procedure that allows for a respondent to respond in a formal way to new facts that have been elicited pre-ITB or new legal issues that have arisen that might result in an additional charge or an additional violation. So we all can take a look at ourselves as much as we can look across the table, I think. But we can also look with pride, I think, at what it hasn't done. Now, I don't think it's fair to make comments that are unbalanced in terms of recognizing all of the things that I think our agency's done in the last several years. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. I misspoke a moment ago when I said the next item on the agenda was Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-04. We still need to approve the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman. Oh, I'm sorry,
Madam
Commissioner
Chair.
Peterson.
Yes, I mean not to. I know that we've all said our piece, and I'd feel left out if I didn't have a chance to say something myself. As Commissioner McGann, as the Vice Chairman McGann pointed out, this whole issue has taken on a life of its own. And in that process, it has obscured the fact, as Commissioner Walther just said, that on 90% to 95% of these matters, there's agreement amongst the commissioners, amongst Office of General Counsel, and I think that shouldn't be overlooked. And I think, as Commissioner Walther also pointed out, there have been a number of very positive developments that have been spearheaded while we've been here. I give the Vice Chairman a great deal of credit for being at the forefront of most of those, and Commissioner Walters has lended a very important support on those as well. And I think that those have made agency procedures better, more transparent, more fair. I think it's enabled us to make better decisions here as commissioners, and I don't think that should be overlooked either. This really does this. The two issues that obviously have generated all the fireworks on this, the pre-RTB stage and the and commission dealings with Department of Justice, obviously those have been the hot button issues that have gotten all the press to get all the discussion, and as well they should, because not only are they issues that deal with what the right policy is, what should be, how should we craft a procedure in a way that we think it gets the right result. Fundamentally, they're about the statute. What does the statute permit the commission to do, and what does the statute prohibit the commission from doing? And that is really at the core of that debate, is what does the statute allow the commission to do at the pre-RTB stage? What can be done before there is a vote to find reason to believe to kick off an investigation? Then obviously on the Department of Justice issue, there are two provisions. We talked a little bit back and forth about when is a majority of three, or when is it a minimum of four. The statute is very clear about referring and reporting to the Department of Justice in terms of requiring four, and obviously those two issues have formed the nub of this debate. Just one red herring that needs to be squished underfoot has been the allegation that somehow I or any of my colleagues want to shut down any communication, shut down any relationship, and impede any sort of ongoing communication lines with the Department of Justice. That's, like I said, a complete red herring and a completely false statement. And how that's gotten into the public bloodstream, I think, is very unfortunate. That somehow that anyone is seeking to impede investigations of the Department of Justice, or that anyone wants from this point forward there to be radio silence between the commission and the department. the concerns, I think, are much more fundamental about what authority the commission has and what jurisdiction we have to make certain referrals and certain materials available to the Department of Justice. And I think that's that's a debate that's been going internally. I think it's one that's been long overdue to be actually for all of the rancor over this issue. We still need to get to this issue to be able to discuss this, because that really gets to the heart of the debate. What authority does the commission have? What does the statute arm us with? And so the sooner that we can get to that debate, I think, in order to resolve those issues, so that we can put into place the, again, 90-95% of the remainder of the enforcement manual that we all agree with, I think it's not only beneficial for us as decision makers and obviously those who work here in the agency, most importantly, it's beneficial for those who have to be subject to our laws and procedures, so that they can know beforehand what are the procedures that the commission is going to apply in the enforcement context. And the sooner that we can do that, I think the better off both everybody inside the building and outside the building will be. Thank you.
Okay, we will now move to the actual agenda. First item is correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it's in order, I can make two motions for the timely submission of the delayed documents.
Feel free.
The way too. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt agenda document number 13-39, minutes for the open session held on August 22nd, 2013.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the minutes for the meeting of August 22, 2013, as set forth in agenda document number 13-39. Is there any discussion on the motion? I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. You have another motion, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to suspend the rules on timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 13-31-C, revised draft A, 13-38, and 13-40. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of, Vice Chairman has moved that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda documents number 13-31-C, 13-38, and 13-40. All in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0.